May my words be spoken in love, in hope, in faith, and in the spirit of truth. A few of you have been to our house, a block off Frederick Street. You may remember that there are two tall bookcases in our family room and a small one in our living room. What you will not know is that there are three more bookcases in our basement, three tall ones and two short ones in our master bedroom, one in our computer room, and four or five knee-high ones in my attic office. We have a lot of books. I haven't read all of them, maybe 80%, and yes, as Marg often reminds me, I should be culling them. But truth be told, I would rather referee, play hockey, chainsaw firewood, fiddle on the piano, bug our choir director and the sopranos during our weekly choir practice, or walk Parker, our golden retriever. Amongst my collection, I have several books by Paul Tillich and by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, both of whom were theological giants in the middle of the last century. Tillich was largely American, Bonhoeffer was German. What distinguishes the two of them, to some extent, is how they came to be known. Tillich, for years, was a renowned professor at Union Seminary in New York, at Harvard, and at the University of Chicago. Bonhoeffer, by contrast, lived largely out of sight. Upon intense reflection, he parted ways with the mainline Protestant church in Germany, and while he could, he led clandestine seminaries for a relative handful of clergy. He worked with close friends and relatives to resist and thwart what Hitler was doing, particularly to the Jews. Sadly, the German authorities eventually found papers that implicated him in a plot to do away with the Führer, and he was executed shortly before the end of the war on April the 9th, 1945, at the age of 39. What many people do not know is that he could have escaped during the last few weeks of his life, as he and other prisoners were being transported haphazardly from the Flossenbürg concentration camp to another location under minimal supervision. But Bonhoeffer chose not to take off because of the consequences he feared his parents and siblings would suffer once German authorities found out about his message. We would know relatively little about Bonhoeffer if it weren't for the fact that he spent an extended time in Tegel prison, 1.5 years, and wrote extensively while living in a very constrained and impoverished life in a very small cell. Many of his papers and letters were smuggled out of the prison and ended up in the hands of family members and his close friend and colleague Eberhard Bethke. Eventually, well after the war, about 6 or 7 years, they were published. Because of their exceptional logic and focus and insight, they became remarkable resources for Christian thinking, what one person has referred to as religious classics. In one of his letters, written after a year in prison in May of 1944, written to Renata, his fiancée, and Eberhard, his best friend, he wrote, "I believe that nothing that happens to me is meaningless, and that it is good for us all that it should be so, even if it runs counter to our own wishes. As I see it, I'm here for some purpose, and I only hope that I may fulfill it." In light of the great purpose, all of our privation and disappointments are trivial. The main point I want to make is that despite his resistance to his country's national combative ambition, despite his own obscurity, and despite only nurturing a very small group of nonconforming pastors, Bonhoeffer ended up on the right side of history. In the late 1930s, rather than follow the mainline Protestant German church, which supported Hitler, he set out to live and preach his faith as he knew it and saw it. What he could not predict or anticipate is that his personal letters and his analytic writings would provide pivotal insights into how we should read the Old Testament, the Gospels, the Psalms, and the Epistles. The title of one of his pivotal books gives you an idea of his perspective. It's called The Cost of Discipleship. In it, he opposes what he perceives as cheap grace and takes to task those who abide by a weak and sloppy set of Christian beliefs. Bonhoeffer died ignominiously, but he was eventually vindicated because he was faithfully on the right side of history. Right now, I think we live in troubled times. The war in Ukraine, mass shootings in the States, the rise of highly politicized right-wing groups such as those that have acted out in Ottawa and Washington, arbitrary violence on Toronto Transit, growing poverty and homelessness, endless opioid overdoses and deaths. The list goes on. I would like to suggest to you that we as a faith community are living for the most part on the right side of history. I think that is important. I want to be careful in making this assertion because Christian churches historically cannot easily or glibly make this claim. We have taken part in cruel crusades, inquisitions, the burning of alleged witches. Many churches have vigorously supported racial segregation, and some still do. Our own Anglican Church is tainted with the grim mistreatment of Indigenous children in our Canadian residential schools, and some of our Anglican churches in Africa have as yet no tolerance for same-sex relations. That said, at St. George's, we are in many ways living out the gospel. We are an unsegregated body of believers open to all. We have an enduring and pervasive commitment to providing food and clothing to the poor and homeless in our community. We have run faith-based camps for young people in the summer. We provide Christmas gifts to those who otherwise would receive none, both the elderly and families in need. We have contributed to the sponsorship of refugee families from countries far away from us, those riven with violence and conflict. We make hundreds of turbans and caps each year for those who lose their hair because of stressful cancer treatments. We support each other on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis when we have an opportunity to provide support for those in our parish stricken with illness, bereavement, or family breakdown. From time to time, we either individually or collectively express criticisms of unjust social policies through letters or petitions or through stinging, pointed homilies. And we provide substantial funds for the Primates World Relief Development Fund as a form of extended outreach. In addition, we are currently providing bursaries to six Native youths to help give them a hand up. I think it is important that we remind each other that to a great extent, we are exercising our decisions and initiatives on the right side of history. We are a little church, no great cathedral, but I am greatly thankful that as a little church, we are arguably carrying more than our weight and doing as much as we can to provide compassion and love to those around us. We are feeding our community's sheep as best we can, where we find them, which confirms the threefold request made of Simon Peter at the end of John's Gospel. It's worth saying that we are not perfect, which is why most Sundays we need to recite the confession. But in a real sense, in our current troubled social context, we are an oasis of thoughtful commitment and renewal, while much of the rest of the world embroils itself in rancorous fights and selfish pursuits. My hope would be that with the support and blessing of the Holy Spirit, we can carry our traditions forward and continue to be on the right side of history. I thought I would end by citing some words written by a famous original writer, E.E. Cummings. In the first half of the last century, he composed some remarkable poetic works that ingeniously reworked and invigorated and transformed standard English. He is somewhat challenging to understand at first glance, but I'm pretty sure you will understand the gist of the following reflection. I am a little church, no great cathedral. Far from the splendor and squalor of hurrying cities, I do not worry if briefer days grow briefest. I am not sorry when sun and rain make April. My life is the life of the reaper and the sower. My prayers are prayers of earth's own clumsily striving, finding and losing and laughing and crying children, whose only sadness or joy is my grief or my gladness. Around me surges a miracle of unceasing birth and glory and death and resurrection. Over my sleeping self float flaming symbols of hope, and I wake to a perfect patience of mountains. I am a little church, far from the frantic world with its rapture and anguish, at peace with nature. I do not worry if longer nights grow longest. I am not sorry when silence becomes singing. Winter by spring, I lift my diminutive spire to merciful Him whose only now is forever. Standing erect in the deathless truth of His presence, welcoming humbly His light and proudly His darkness.